Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we are continuing with our series of POTUS 47 conversations as we will focus in on a recent update, banking on regulatory reform. I will point out up front to our listeners and our clients, all updates and resources as it relates to POTUS 47 are available for you on UBS.com/POTUS47, including today's feature. So with that, let's meet our speakers for today. We are joined here in our studio at 1285 Avenue of the Americas by Barry McAlinden, Senior Fixed Income Strategist for the Americas, as well as Jeff Harwood, his first appearance with us here on Top of the Morning. Jeff is the Financials Equity Analyst Americas, both joining us here today from the UBS Chief Investment Office. So with that, Barry, Jeff, great to be at the table with you both. Thank you for dropping by and for spending some time today with our listeners.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Great. So let's get right into it for some context, Barry. What does the regulatory backdrop look like today for the banking sector?
Yeah, so first, I think in context, you know, it's much stronger than it was prior to the global financial crisis. You know, it's rooted really in recommendations by the Global Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. And the Dodd-Frank Act was a law in the U.S. that established really enhanced standards for capital liquidity. So for U.S. banks, it's, especially the large banks, it's really considered to be gold-plated. But I think it's accepted now that it's pretty complex and overlapping. So, you know, we're in a position where some of the calculations, especially as it relates to the capital rules, have become a bit outdated and can create unpredictability for bank management teams. So regulatory reform in the U.S. banking system is actually something that has been, you know, in the works really before the U.S. administration, you know, changed over last fall. But momentum has really gained traction, of course, with new regulatory heads in place at agencies like the Fed, the OCC, and the FDIC. So we want to just kind of recap, you know, this momentum in the report. And, you know, we really focus on two main areas of reform. One is capital reform, which is kind of the biggest, you know, part of this. And then some other areas like in non-capital reform, such as bank examinations, which, you know, should be changing to be a little bit more focused on safety and soundness and less focus on things like reputational risk. As well as non-capital reform in terms of like how bank ratings are derived, which the changes could improve the outlook for actually bank mergers and acquisitions, which because the way that they're derived right now tends to inhibit that a little bit. So, you know, our overall takeaways, and we'll get into more details, but I just wanted to make the point, you know, we do expect some benefits from this reform in the form of greater clarity, particularly on the capital front, flexibility for bank management teams. But it's also important what we don't expect the reform to do. Like, we don't think that any of these key foundational elements that have really, you know, put the foundation in place for safety and soundness of the U.S. banking system is likely to be diminished. So, you know, we don't really view this as something that's going to cause a less stable U.S. banking system. We don't see, you know, reintroduction of systemic risks, excessive leverage or things like that, excessive risk-taking behavior by the banks. Again, we view these changes as something that's more of normalization and something that had really been in the works even prior to the current U.S. administration.
Well, Barry, that's very helpful clarity. And with that backdrop in mind, Jeff, to welcome you into the conversation, how might capital requirements change here for the banks going forward?
Sure. So there are two key high-level points. One, banks will likely be required to hold somewhat less capital than current rules. And two, capital requirements will be less volatile from year to year. And so there are four key reforms that we're watching right now that will likely result in easier capital requirements. The first is the SLR, the Supplemental Leverage Ratio. So this isn't really a hugely impactful ratio for the banks or the reform for the banks. But what it does is actually enables reforms to other capital ratios that banks also face. But so the SLR is currently underway. Another reform we're watching is stress tests. The process for the stress test is going to be revised somewhat. And this is likely going to result in less volatile capital requirements from year to year. Right now, the banks, they get a new capital ratio every single year as to what they have to hold. That's going to be smoothed out a little bit from year to year, so less volatility there. The third reform we're watching is the G-SIB surcharge. This is unique to U.S. banks. And this one is actually some common sense reforms. It's some low-hanging fruit. Some of the inputs just need to be inflation adjusted or simply indexing to GDP growth. And because this is kind of a common sense reform, there's been broad support from various parties. And so there's less pushback there for G-SIB surcharge reform. And then the last initiative we're watching is the Basel III endgame. This is a pretty big proposal, and it's created significant uncertainty for a couple of years now, because it was initially going to be very impactful and potentially raise capital requirements meaningfully for a handful of the largest banks. Now, however, finalization of Basel III is likely going to be capital neutral, and finally getting clarity on this big proposal likely allows management to finally deploy some of that excess capital. So this is a complex reform, though, so there is some risk of delays, and it's the Federal Reserve in accordance with the OCC and the FDIC. So having a few agencies does create some risk of delays. But importantly, and as Barry said, these capital reforms are really just a normalization of regulations and just refining certain inputs. This is not a full unwind or a reversal of policy. Banks will still hold a lot of capital, and safety and soundness is not really a concern for us. And the timeline is actually relatively quick. So the SLR and stress test updates are likely going to happen this year, potentially the next few weeks. The G-SIB surcharge, hopefully by year end, but potentially early 2026. And then Basel III endgame, we're hearing that the Federal Reserve is targeting a 1Q26 deadline. So again, relatively quick. And importantly, these reforms can be implemented just by regulators. There's no need for an act of Congress or any kind of political backdrop issues there. This is all on the regulatory front.
So there's a lot there to be mindful of, and a lot of that lends itself, Jeff, to perhaps some future follow-up conversations we can have on this. Though, in the meantime, what are the implications here, Jeff, for equity investors?
Sure. So management teams will finally have greater confidence to deploy excess capital. On earnings calls for the last maybe 2 to 3 years, when they're asked about when are they going to deploy this capital, management teams have consistently said they just need clarity on what the capital rules are. So when they finally do get this clarity, that means they can deploy this excess capital. That translates into upside to buybacks, upside to dividend growth, and banks can just invest more in growth initiatives now. And so to put some numbers behind it, we potentially see $200 to $300 billion of excess capital right now. So importantly, this isn't just going to be deploying cash also. So when you think about a capital ratio, there's a numerator and a denominator. Deploying capital into buybacks and dividends and growth, that just reduces the numerator. If you think about the other side of the equation, they could actually increase the size of their balance sheet also. And by our estimation, we see $1 to $3 trillion of potential balance sheet capacity, which translates into more earnings power. And so we think the stocks aren't fully reflecting the potential upside, just given the complexity of these regulations. So we do have a favorable view of these regulations in the context of stock prices.
Thank you, Jeff, for the equity side. On the fixed income side, Barry, what are some implications investors should be mindful of?
I think investors should be mindful of the overall credit profiles of the banks, as well as the supply and demand of securities that banks issue into the fixed income marketplace, like preferred securities or corporate bonds. I think in terms of their overall credit profiles, look, you know, actually deploying excess capital, you could argue that that is negative from a fixed income or, you know, credit investor point of view. But, you know, in the context of banks that already hold excess capital, you know, we see their credit profiles remaining intact. And even for reforms such as Basel III, as Jeff mentioned, you know, likely to be a bit capital neutral. The SLR reform, yes, it's likely to reduce Tier 1 capital requirements by the large U.S. G-SIB banks, but only about the low single digits by the bank holding companies, and they're still going to be bound by other ratios, such as risk-based ratios, that'll, you know, help safeguard their credit profiles. In terms of the securities that are issued into the marketplace, so some of the calculation proposed changes affecting SLR would also affect how much debt they're required to have on their balance sheets for regulatory purposes. Maybe that's something that not all investors really appreciate, is that, you know, regulators actually want a minimum amount of debt that the banks to hold. The idea is that, you know, you have enough securities to absorb losses so that in case of a worst case scenario of a bank failure, taxpayers wouldn't have to bail them out. The securities would kind of bail in, help to protect depositors. So the reforms are saying that the amount of long-term debt requirements are not going to be quite as onerous as the current calculation, you know, is presently. I think on the margin, you know, it's kind of a net supply benefit for these securities. If it helps incrementally reduce the supply of bonds, you know, just kind of creates a positive supply-demand dynamic. You know, that said, though, you know, the large U.S. banks are the largest issuers of U.S. corporate investment grade bonds, so they're still going to be plentiful in the marketplace, but nonetheless, a reduction at the margin. We can think about preferred securities, too, which probably a little bit, you know, more streamlined in terms of how much needs to be on their balance sheet for purposes of counting towards additional Tier 1 capital. So really, you know, kind of being more efficient and how much preferred is on the balance sheet. And then, you know, finally, I guess something that's really important and really kind of the genesis of this SLR reform is, you know, banks' ability to kind of intermediate in the treasury bond market. You know, that's something that there was relief temporary put in place during COVID because, again, these SLR calculations kind of are a bit onerous as far as counting like treasuries, which are, you know, safe assets as something that, you know, they have to, you know, put capital against. And the proposal is going to help alleviate that a bit. So it should allow for, let's say, better intermediation, you know, trading of treasury securities by the largest banks, you know, which tend to be, you know, some of the highest volume, you know, participants in the treasury market. Also, you know, increase their ability to add treasuries or other high quality instruments like agency mortgage-backed securities onto their balance sheet as part of like their securities portfolio. I would say, like, with that said, though, you know, we don't expect the banks in terms of deploying this balance sheet capacity. It's not like they're going to all of a sudden, you know, focus specifically on treasury securities. They're going to do other growth initiatives like mm-hmm. Jeff talked about. But again, you know, I think it is a positive development or outcome from the kind of just the overall fixed income market dynamic that could arise from these proposals.
Well, Barry, Jeff, thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning today, keeping our listeners, our clients informed. I know this is a notable point of interest and a lot here we can follow up on as these reforms progress. So do look forward to having you both back and having some follow-up conversations in the months ahead.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Dan.
Absolutely. And I do want to point out to our listeners, our clients, again, the update, Banking on Regulatory Reform, as part of the POTUS 47 series from the UBS Chief Investment Office, can now be located up on UBS.com/POTUS47. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit UBS.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit UBS.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.